Well, good morning, everyone. I think you can hear me a little clearer this morning. We're going to start off dealing with emotional issues, and we're going to show a DVD first, and I want you to watch what happens. We all get hurt with things, and that follows right through our lives, and I want you to watch this DVD and watch how it played out in his life and then in his marriage. So let's watch that.
Santa Rosa, California, just a few less than 1,000 people, quite a few less. There's about 80 folks gather on a Sunday. They realize the truth that once a Cornhusker, always a Cornhusker. I was raised in Omaha. We've been in Santa Rosa for about 30 years. We've heard this morning stories, or a couple of times, you know, these are stories you can't mention in church. And I'm a pastor, and I want to tell you this morning a story that I did tell in church, and it started a revival in that church, not in numbers, but in depth. And we have a church, honestly, excuse me, I've been weeping all morning. We have a church, honestly, where men come together and meet, and they actually love each other. No holds barred. The other day, one of the fellas said, "Hey, you love your wife, right?" "Oh, yeah, I love her. She's the most precious person." He said, "How about your daughter? Do you ever look her in the eye and tell her you love her?" "Oh, I'm going to go do that." And he went and did it. We have a group of ladies that they'll get together, and they don't compare with each other. They don't compare each other to other things. They just love each other. Well, the story I want to share this morning, actually it's the results of the story that's important, but I often get calls from desperate ladies on the phone. Guys won't call me. We're that way, aren't we, guys? We don't need counseling. But they're desperate, and I say, "Please, could I talk to your husband? Just get him on the phone." "But we've had thousands of hours of counseling and spent all this money." I said, "I just want to talk to him because I understand. I'm not going to beat him up. I'm not going to make him do anything. I just want to talk to his heart." And he'll call and say, "Go ahead, give it a shot. Give it your best shot." And I'll say, "Sir, you know, there was a king in the Bible. And they said, they introduced him. They said, his name is Solomon, son of David, king of Israel." And I said, "If I had a Bible name, it would be Leroy, son of Ivan, sheep shearer from Omaha." I love the sheep stories. I grew up around them. My parents, my dad sheared sheep all his life, and may have sheared for some of you, I don't know. We went on an adventure as a family one summer to Alaska. I was in high school, and we went to shear 7,000 head of sheep out on Umnak Island, 900 miles west of Anchorage. We flew out there. Wonderful adventure. Very lonely place for a guy like me. Didn't have my friends. Didn't have activities. On the outside, it looked okay. It was kind of robust. We were wranglers. We rode horses, rounded up sheep, sheared them, etc. But inside, I was growing emptier and emptier. The manager of the ranch was probably the meanest, nastiest, most bitter man that I think I've ever met. And I've met a bunch of them since, but not like him. He would sometimes just stop and swear. For about 5 minutes, he would just have to swear. He'd just cuss. And then he would sort of take a deep breath, and then he'd come after us and explain what we were supposed to do for the day. And he was just kind of a crazy guy like that. I know now that he was deeply hurt inside. Well, we would round up sheep, and he had some sheepdogs that worked for him pretty well. Two of them did, and one of them wouldn't respond to his gruff voice, and he wanted to get rid of it, and so he said to me one day, I don't know why, but he said, "Hey, Leroy, do you want a dog?" I said, "I'd love to have a dog. I've never had a dog of my own." And he said, "Take that one." And I said, "Oh, this is great. I've got it was a border collie. Nice dog." And I had no idea how I was going to get it home to Omaha, but I had a dog. And I took that dog, And it worked with me. And we would round up sheep. I would be riding. And sheepdogs work very well, save a lot of wear and tear on your horse, especially if you're in the mountains. And so I could get Toby to work for me. He would hear my voice, much gentler than George's, and he would follow. And he was a companion. Well, we were rounding up sheep one day, and I just have to tell you one fact about herding sheep. When you come to a river with a bridge across it, in order to get a large band, we had about 1,000 head we were herding that day, across the river, you crowd them up to the river, and then you hold them right there. You can't swim sheep across the river because they sink. Not good for business. So you crowd them up to the river and you hold them there. And one will get curious and go across the bridge, and then they'll all follow. You swim your horse across the bridge, catch them on the other side, and you trail them on home. Well, we were rounding up sheep, and I was using my dog, and I was just coming over the ridge and bringing the last little bunch in to this big herd. And this is the scene that I saw. Just before I came over the ridge, I heard George swearing. And I thought, oh boy, what's the problem now? And at the same time, I looked around and I said, where's my dog? Couldn't find him. Didn't think anything of it. I came over the ridge and I joined the herd, and this is what I saw. 1,000 sheep. The wranglers were holding the sheep by the bridge. And George was clear across the flock looking at the bridge. I looked over at the bridge and there was my dog standing on the bridge. And I thought to myself, I've got to get to the bridge. I've got to get to the dog because he'll come off if he hears me. So I started to ride, and then I saw across the herd, George was riding, thundering toward the bridge, and so I kicked my horse. Pretty desperate. I'm a young kid, and I got to get the dog off the bridge. Just before I got there, George got there first, drew a gun, and shot the dog. Shot him in the stomach, didn't kill him. And so the dog finally, then he heard my voice, and he came to me, and I can still see the look in his eyes. He's looking at me saying, Leroy, my friend, I'm hurting. About that time, my dad rode up to me. He's a good father, but he didn't know what to do with a son in this problem. And he said, well, Lee, you know what you got to do. And he rode away, left me there. I knew what I had to do. I drew my pistol. I looked at the dog and I shot him. It was either that or he'd die a miserable death. And then I did the only thing I knew to do. I turned my horse around and I rode. I kicked ribbon so hard and I rode for about 2 hours, about killed the horse. But I was crying, and I told your kids this story. And I said, boys, it's okay to cry. It's all right. It's an expression of your soul. And I just rode, and you know, after that 2 hours, I guess I was sort of worn out. I was finished, stuffed it inside, and went on with life. 32 years later, sitting in John's office, he said, you've got a guy listed here on your sheet, name of George. What's that about? I said, it's nothing. It wasn't anything to me. I had never known what to do with it until then. Nothing. Well, tell me about it. I started to tell the story, and I couldn't. And so brokenly, I told him, and we started to deal with that pain. And you see, what I realized was that I was in forgiving George. I was dealing with 30 years of marriage that it had cost me. 30 years that I had lost of the ability to do what I needed to do as a husband and father. You see, I had made a decision that day. I put a wall up in my heart, and I said, nobody like that is ever going to hurt me again. Nobody's going to get in. I can't take it. I don't want to take it. I don't have to take it. So I put up a strong barrier against anybody like that. Anybody that's outgoing and sort of a take-charge person with talents and abilities. Guess who I married? She's the most talented, able person. She had the talent to be the first woman president. Hillary beat her to it, but she's God made her that way. And You see, what I missed, because any time that I would feel like she was opening up like that, what happened in my heart? Up came the block. And how much do you suppose she married when she married me? In just whatever would dribble over the top. And you know why it was so amazing to us? That it was just incredible. When I was able to forgive and say, I'm willing to pay for the emotional pain and the consequences. And this is a big one, was the consequences for 30 years in my marriage. When I could forgive, that wall came down. And she saw someone that she didn't recognize. And the same with her. She was abandoned. She was left alone. And when that wall came down, I thought, this is gorgeous. This is beautiful. I want this. And you see, whenever she would just be herself and feel a little outgoing to me, the wall would come up. And you know what happened in my heart? Got on my horse, rode over the hill. Most of the time. A little later on, I learned how to fight. What kind of a marriage is that? Real good Christian on the outside, isn't it? But inside we're dying. When those walls came down, something beautiful happened. You see, I learned, and when she sat there in the office and heard my story, I looked over at her and I saw compassion. I felt compassion that I'd never felt before, and I thought, this is right. This is what Jesus meant when he went after the one, left the 99, and said, I'm not willing that one, even if his name is Leroy, would perish. I want him to have fullness. I'm going after him, and he came after me. Took the wall down. So now, rather than feel threatened, I want to protect her heart. I want to take care of her. Because you're precious. Can I just end with this? Do you want to say anything?
No.
Okay. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound. That saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, hurt, bitter, rejected, alone. But now I'm free. Galatians 5:1 says it was for freedom that Christ died. He forgave us that we might be free. How are we free? We were set free by his death. We stay free by our death, by our willingness to choose to forgive, to pay for the consequences, for the pain that others have caused us, and to be free. You know, my heart's been weeping today because our hearts are all like that, aren't we? We desire for the touch of the Lord Jesus Christ that we've never known before. He's touched me the deepest, and nothing has touched me so deep inside as when I see Jesus in her eyes. And that's her story.
Well, that testimony illustrates a few things. One of the things it does illustrate, here's a person in full-time ministry for decades and still has issues in his heart to deal with. And you know what? That's okay. We are all a work in progress, aren't we? And we never really arrive. And sometimes it's easy to look at somebody who gets up here and speaks about this kind of thing. Well, you must have it just all together and everything works great. We still have our issues too. And we're still a work in progress. Back to your notes there in the emotional issues session or section there. Everyone gets damaged in some way. I literally don't think there's a person that doesn't get damaged somehow. We all get damaged. We just need to really come to accept that. And we get damaged in two ways. First of all, we get damaged when things happen to us that cause us pain. And secondly, we can get damaged emotionally when things don't happen that should have happened. If a person grows up in a home where mom and dad or one of them can't connect emotionally and everything is intellectual, there's going to be a disconnect there, and that's going to cause hurt because we were all made to have emotional connection. Could be a great home, but no emotional connection. That wasn't what happened. That was what didn't happen that should have happened. Well, how does emotional damage affect a person? First of all, it affects how we view ourselves. Recently, I counseled a couple, and this particular gal, she grew up in a Christian home, but her dad was so busy doing ministry. He was an elder. He traveled around preaching and never had time for her. And she remembered as a little girl constantly coming up to him. He would be sitting in his chair with his newspaper. And she'd want his attention. Daddy, daddy. And he would pull the paper down. And the attitude was, what? And as soon as she started talking a little bit, he'd be glancing back at the paper. And the paper would go up again. So what does that do? How did that affect her? Well, she felt like she was a bother. She was a burden. Here's this little girl that just wants some attention. And dad just couldn't give it. He couldn't give her his heart to her. Well, that affected her the rest of her life. And so whenever she looks at her husband and wants to ask him something, or she felt like she could never have a need, what we all do, but she couldn't ask because she would be a burden. So it affects how we view ourselves. It also affects how we treat other people. In that testimony we showed last night, here's a gal who got anger thrown at her, and she showed anger then. So that's the way she treated her own family, and she realized, I'm becoming just like my mother. It affects how we treat other people. It also affects how we view God. We tend to see God the way we see major authorities in our life. And the authorities that we are most familiar with growing up, as we start to learn and love about life, as we're a toddler and so on, mom and dad, they control life, and I have to do what they say, and they're in charge. And we tend to transfer whatever mom and dad are like, we transfer that to God. So if you have a father or a mother who's harsh and easily angered, that child will grow up thinking God is kind of the same way. So he kind of carries a big stick. And if you get out of line, you get a whack. And we really transfer it that way. It affects how we view God. And we'll talk more about that when we get into the next session, when we talk about a particular kind of abuse that's called spiritual abuse. And it affects how we view God. Number four, it affects how we respond to others when they touch our pain. And we saw that in that testimony there. As soon as his wife, who was just being herself, would hit that spot, and who would take charge, he'd get on his horse and rode over the hill. So it affects how we respond to others who touch those pain spots. God made us all with the ability to give love and receive love from the heart. Some people think, well, I'm not that kind of person who can go heart. Well, you know what? God made us all with that ability. We may not exercise it, but it's in there. And I've seen some people who are just all intellectual get into their heart, and they really can start to receive love and give love from the heart so people can feel that. Unresolved emotional and or spiritual issues can block this ability. Okay, we're going to look at pressure patterns, and you have a handout there, and you're not going to have to write too much in your book there. It's just pretty much on that sheet. I thought I'd give that sheet, make it easier for you. But what is a pressure pattern? A pressure pattern is emotional stress or pressure that can be put on a person that damages them. That's what pressure patterns are. And the first thing we want to look at is performance, expectations, self-discipline. Could somebody get me one of those sheets I'll take one each if Gwen's there somewhere. Performance expectations. Thank you. There's a definition here of what it means when somebody puts on expectations, pressure to perform, self-discipline, to accomplish an action, to achieve, to apply oneself, to carry out, to expect, to count upon. Now, it's one thing we have to understand about pressure patterns is they're not necessarily wrong. Nothing wrong with being self-disciplined and encouraging your children to accomplish. But you know what? Sometimes we put that pressure on, and especially if there's no emotional connection with it, there's no love there. And when I say there's no love, I don't mean you don't love your child. You die for your children. But if they can't connect emotionally and they get this pressure to perform, it does something to them. That's one of the pressures I got. What it does, it makes you anxious inside, where you have to perform, you have to keep doing things, and you can never do it good enough. You can never do it. You never get done. Usually, a person that gets this kind of pressure put on them is a list person. They always have a list. They work off a list. And the thing is, their list never gets done. And if they ever did get done their list, they make a new list. Because they're pushed, and it makes us respond emotionally that I can't do enough. And we try to perform to get love. And we can even transfer that to God. There was one missionary I read about. He spent 20 years on the mission field working for God. But he had this kind of pressure, and he couldn't do enough. If he had 30 hours in a day, he'd just keep going and going. And finally, he just burned out. Came back home, got some help, and started to realize, you know what? God accepts me if I don't do anything. God just accepts me if I don't do anything. And he was working to get love. Then he started to realize, God already loves me. I don't have to do anything to get his love. Totally changed his life. He went back to the mission field, probably worked just as hard, but he wasn't working from a basis of stress. He was working from a basis of, I'm already at the top of the ladder. I'm not climbing the ladder through my good works and performance to get to God. I'm already there. Now I can work for him because he loves me and I love him. That's performance expectations. Then there's dominance and controlling. Nothing wrong with a dominant person. Do you know the dominant people make the world go round? They like to organize. If you put 10 people in a room and gave them a project to do that didn't know each other, you know what's going to happen? First of all, the more dominant people are going to start saying, well, why don't we get organized here? What would you like to do? And depending on how he handles that will depend how the people will respond to that. Nothing wrong with someone who's dominant. It's when you start adding things to dominance. If you add dominance and high expectations, what do you mean you only got 95 on that test? You could have done better. They'll never do enough. Then they get frustrated. So dominance plus high expectations will frustrate. You take dominance and anger, people get overwhelmed and they can't function. Add dominance to pride, you're going to control. We moved our office 2 years ago to Wingham, and the person that owns the building we're in, he's a very dominant person. And he owns Royal Homes there in Wingham, and not active in that. He just wants to be involved in ministry, so he wanted to get some counseling in his complex there. So we agreed to that. But he's a joy to work with. Very dominant. He gets things done. But he listens to you. He hears you. He doesn't dominate, doesn't control with his dominance. He's just a pleasure to work with. But he's a get-it-done person. So there's nothing wrong with some of these expectations. Some of these pressure patterns. It's what we mix them with. Then there's expressive. To be able to communicate, to express oneself, able to articulate their thoughts clearly. Now, is there anything wrong with that? No, that is a good thing to have when you can articulate your thoughts and express yourself. But what happens when that person uses that and doesn't let somebody else express themselves? And you get told maybe what you like and what you don't like. And so you're talked over. And sometimes an expressive person doesn't even realize they're doing it. Again, some of these pressure patterns that happen to us in our homes, we're not bad people. We're just doing what we are sometimes. You know, sometimes you can have two children in a home, and let's say you have two kind of go-getter parents, and they get things done, and they're organized, they're self-disciplined, and they don't put any pressure on the children. But the children watch this. And you can have one child who is of that temperament that goes along with that. And they'll just think mom and dad were great. The other person is more of a laid-back person, and that's what we're born with. Sometimes we're just more laid-back. And they can just watch mom and dad be busy with life, and they just get nervous, like, I can't do that. And so some of these things happen, and it's not even the fault, per se, of a parent. But we live in a fallen world, and we all get hurt. And sometimes, even when we're just being ourselves, and that's what I think that preacher was talking about yesterday when he said to Gary Goodkey, you know, you're going to mess your child up, you realize. We just will. We just have to be big enough to own it and start to realize what is going on. Then there's focus on self. Selfish, proud, self-centered, arrogant, conceited, self-seeking. Now, sometimes we grow up around people like that, and we get damaged by that. We tend to be self-focused ourselves. And an alcoholic, a person who grows up in an alcoholic home, will also have an issue with self-focus, because that pressure from a parent who's an alcoholic is self-focus. An alcoholic is focused on their pain all the time. That's why they drink. They can't connect. And so that's a pressure that comes to bear. And that can cause real challenges. Then there's anger, criticalness, judgmental, attitude, adverse comments, fault finding, to disapprove, to condemn, hearing cutting words. Those all do something to us. You know, whenever anybody is angry, there's always a reason for it. Unresolved bitterness can just make a person angry. Moral failure that's unresolved can cause anger. Low self-esteem. Pride can cause anger. I just can't get my own way, so I get angry. And finally, there's one more here, not talked to. Sometimes we grow up in homes where we're just not talked to, like that gal I just shared in the beginning. And so we shut down emotionally, and we feel like we're just abandoned and neglected. So that's a little bit of pressure patterns. And there's other emotional issues too. And again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these. You have them on your sheet there, on the other side of the sheet. Other emotional issues defined, there's abandonment. Whenever you have divorce in a family, the children almost always are suffering from abandonment to one extent or another. Sometimes we're neglected, and I won't spend a lot of time on these. Being ignored, treated insensitively, emotional detachment, rejection, disowned, humiliated, despised, disrespected, betrayed, and drained emotionally. Now, what does that mean, to be drained emotionally? Well, sometimes if a mom isn't getting her emotional needs met by her husband, she'll go to her children for it. And she'll tell the child, her 10-year-old child, their problems and what she's struggling with and not getting along with dad, or she pours her heart out to her child. Well, you know what that does to the child? They don't have any capacity to handle that kind of thing. They're not old enough. They can't handle it. So they get this pressure. What happens when they grow up? Well, they grow up and they've got that pain spot in there, and their spouse starts to pour their heart out a little bit. What are they going to do? Whatever they did in response to their parent, that's how they're going to respond to their spouse. That's an example of being drained emotionally. Now, whenever we get hurt, we always respond with something. We don't do nothing. Everybody responds to how we've been hurt. And there's a list there of some of the ways that we can respond. I even wrote them up for you. You can just listen instead of writing. Emotionally detaching. To give you an example of that, and I think that's a God-given ability when pain gets so bad that they can just emotionally detach. One gal would be regularly sexually abused by her father, and every time he came in the room at night, she would just leave the room emotionally and wouldn't even remember what happened. And that's tied in with dissociation. Sometimes you can lose memory. And I'm dealing with a gal right now on a regular basis that has blocks in her memory that are just totally gone. She can't remember them. The pain was so bad. So we dissociate. Sometimes in response to pain, we just self-focus on it. Just continually self-focus. Sometimes we control and dominate. I had a person come in once, and they sat down with his wife, and he just wanted to, he was there because she drug him there, and he just wanted to set the record straight as to what this was all about. So he said, "I just want you to know something." He was telling me and his wife, "I do what I want to do, and nobody tells me what to do." And he said that because he just wanted to set the stage. So whenever we start moving on something, he's going to remind us. And he did. Every once in a while, he'd say, "Just remember what I said now. I do what I want to do, and nobody tells me what to do." Well, I know one thing that happened to him. Just by that comment, somebody so controlled him that at some point in his life he said, that's it. Never again. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. That's a response to pain. He wouldn't tell me his story. He didn't want any help, really. He just was there because his wife wanted him there, and he was going to set everything straight. That's a response to pain. He said he had a wonderful life, no problems whatsoever. It was all her problem. Sometimes we just get angry. Sometimes we get critical and judgmental. Sometimes people just freeze up. Somebody hits their pain, they just stop talking. They just freeze. They can't talk. Sometimes they just walk away. Sometimes they go to alcohol, drugs, or lust. I would say the majority of the people that get caught up in pornography and lust like that, it's really like alcohol. It's a cover for all the pain, because when they're indulging in that, they don't feel the pain. And so it becomes just like alcohol. And if you don't solve that problem, it's hard to get out of the lust. Performance. Some people respond to pain by just go to work. And work 15 hours a day. And they're just running from pain. Sometimes they lie to protect themselves. Sometimes they just get defiant. Become a clown. That's one thing I did. Not a clown, defiance. Some people just stop talking. Just won't talk. Some people talk nonstop. I had a gal in my office. Literally, if I let her talk, she would talk 15 hours straight. And the thing is, she never took breaths. I don't know how she did it physically. I try to look for a way to get in. And all the time, she's avoiding me letting her get into her heart. So that's the response to pain. If I keep talking and control everything, you can't ask me a question. You can't start getting inside. Now, the reality is here, we all have package stuff. And when you come to a weekend like this, you know what? I know it can be very overwhelming. And how do I work on this stuff? And it just seems like too much, and you start hearing this problem, and I got that problem, and it just gets really frustrating. We want to make this weekend as practical as possible, and just how do I put all this together? Now, you got another sheet there with three boxes on it, and this helps to simplify this whole thing. Three boxes, and you can put some of this in your additional notes there if you want. But I'm going to have Gwen come up right now. My wife's here somewhere. And we're just going to demonstrate our own package of stuff, because we got a package just like you do. And we all get hurt. We talked about this a little bit last night. And we get hurt with emotional issues and spiritual issues. And I showed you this list last night. Emotional issues and spiritual issues that we all struggle with. And we can all go down there and we can find things on both sides of there that we struggle with. When you're dealing with emotional issues, how you resolve that is by prayer and allowing the Lord Jesus to bring peace. Spiritual issues take repentance. If I'm bitter, I need to repent of that. I need to get rid of that bitterness through repentance. So, we all get hurt, then we all feel something because of that hurt. And that's where the pain words come in. That's the other side of the sheet. So, you can look at this first box here. I close my heart when someone gets angry with me. And you can go down that list, and you can start checking off things. Yeah, when somebody criticizes me, something goes, so that would be something you would check off. that shows there's an issue there. Or when somebody controls me, yeah, that's when I start to struggle. It starts to reveal what some of the challenges are. So then it's going to make you feel certain things. There's the pain words. Then we all respond with something. We all react with something because of that pain that happened inside. Now I'm just going to kind of walk through here, and we're just going to show you our stuff. And the reason why we're doing this, not to talk about ourselves, but it helps you to see how this really works and how it plays out in marriage. Here's the stuff that I was hurt with. I had high expectations put on me with a lot of anger. And I'll give you one example. My dad owned a seed processing plant, and we had some land and growing seed and so on. And so he would be on the combine, I would be on the tractor with the wagon. So the combine fills up, have to empty it into the wagon and the tractor and take it away. Well, I'm probably 11, 12 years old. And so my dad was always in a hurry and couldn't relax, and pressure when he was working. And so you didn't stop the combine to unload. No, you drove the tractor beside the combine at the same speed, and then you would empty the combine while you're driving. Well, that's an efficient way. The trouble I had was, my uncles had a tractor dealership or an implement dealership, and that's where we got our tractors from, and we'd be getting a tractor of the week, you know. We just got all the ones that people traded in, and some of the tractors sped up with the hand handle coming back, some sped up going this way, and every week we had a different tractor. And so I'm 12 years old, and I had to drive this tractor beside this combine perfectly. It wasn't a very big wagon, so if you go a little faster, it starts to spill. Well, one time I got this tractor, and I'm doing the best I can, and I got it right beside the combine, and it started going a little bit faster than the combine. And my dad starts saying, "Well, slow down, slow down." And he starts, and when he started yelling and screaming, my mind went blank. I didn't know what to do. I think I just froze. I had to do something. So I grabbed that handle, and I just cranked it. And that was how it sped up, didn't slow down. And I took off down the field, and the grain is spilling all over the ground. This granular gold. And it was more important than I was. That's the kind of thing. You know, my dad did deal with that, and he apologized for that because he destroyed me that day. I couldn't even think. So I'm tearing down the field. I know how to stop this tractor now. I can't think. I'm glad it was a big field. There was no trees in it. Finally, the clutch. Oh, yeah. Boom. Got that thing slowed down. High expectations. So that's one of my things. So if I get pressure that way, I start to feel that. Got anger, got dominated. My sister's on the piano here. She's the one that kind of controlled me. And I'll tell you more about that later. But I got that. And criticized and judged. So when I get criticized, I start to feel that. So that's my package of stuff. So you go through that first list and say, what do I relate to here? And you start to see how you are hurt. Well, that made me feel useless. I can't do it right. I just can't do it fast enough, good enough. So I just feel like giving up. Never measure up. Probably the best word I could describe how I felt, but I just felt rejection. And then I responded with this. I would get depressed. I would just get angry. I go back and forth with those two things. I do things like plan my funeral. I wasn't suicidal. I just thought, you know what? If I died and I'm in the casket and you're all standing, then you'll know how much you hurt me. Pride, self-focus, self-pity. At one point in my mid-teens, I decided I don't want to feel that stuff anymore. So I just locked it away. I'm not going to feel that. I got every positive motivational book I could find, and I became Mr. Terrific. Everything's terrific. In fact, one job I had, they called me Mr. T, because they ever asked me how I am. I'm terrific. And I was. But I locked all the stuff down here, and I just went ahead. And that's what my wife married. Locked to feelings, self-focus. So that's some of my stuff. You go ahead and do your stuff.
Okay, you have to move it, though.
Okay.
Because I got to see what it is. I have to remember. Okay.
Oh.
Okay, and then we have me coming along, and I grew up in a completely different household. There were five children in our family, and we were all 5 years apart. And so it was like we were a whole bunch of firstborns, you know. And when I would want to go places with my siblings, they'd say, "No, you're too little. No, you can't come." And that went right up until the teens. And I just kind of did my own thing. Now, as I remember that, I had a special place where I would go. I'd go on a hike or I'd make forts places, but I was always by myself. And it was like I didn't mind that. As I think back, it was good times. I would have fun and I would do my thing, but it's going to play into what's going to happen later on. There was a lot of... I was loved in that I was looked after. I knew I was loved. This is what you hear all the time. I know they loved me, but they never told me that they loved me in my parents. It was kind of like that era. You just didn't talk about that much. You'd give a hug and, you know, make sure you got all your meals and your clothes and all that kind of thing. But you weren't really affirmed that you were loved. There was a lot of busyness in our household, and so you try to say something, but nobody's really listening, so then you're not listened to. High expectations. You got 95. Well, why? I mean, you only got a few wrong. Why didn't you get 100? Like, what's wrong, you know? And so then you're always thinking, just what's the point? My father was an alcoholic, not an abusive person in that, he held a steady job. He was soft, and he actually probably showed love to me more than my mother would have, but very self-focused, go by himself, kind of like what I did. So, next one. So that would have made it so that I was feeling that nobody cares, I'm all alone, I'm worthless, inadequate, pressure to perform. I would be detached, and then I would respond by myself emotionally detaching. I remember in high school, I didn't like high school, and I was, if you want to say smart academically, I didn't have to study up until I got to grade 11 or 12, and then I thought, oh dear, I guess I have to study now, but I would sit in class, and I could be all over the world. I would just be thinking about, I wasn't listening to a thing that was said. Just did my own thing. Again, I kind of took control of my own life. I thought, okay, well, I'm off now. I'm going to school. I'm getting out of here, you know. So I could just go and do what I was going to do. Perfectionist, somewhat. Everything had to be right. I think that was from the high expectations. So now I'm going to take you into what our cycle would be. Now we've been doing this counseling for about 12 years, and there were other cycles. There's all kinds of cycles that you get into, but by a cycle I mean where you really butt heads and you think, why can't we figure this out? What's the matter here?
Let me just say one thing here if I could. Too.
Keep pressing each other's buttons.
Yeah. How I respond to my stuff. And this is typical in almost every marriage. How I respond to my stuff will hit her where she hurts the most. And how she responds hits me where I hurt the most. Not to my stuff. How she responds to her own things will typically hit me. And that's where you get this cycle going. Sorry.
A little thing, like I noticed when we were first married, I would say, could you do this or could you do that? And it often didn't go well. And I thought, what is the problem here? He would react. Well, then I found out And maybe he'll tell, his mother would nag him, and, you know, and so he would just kind of block her off. And then I realized, okay, whatever I'm asking is reminding him and pushing his buttons. But I'm going to come to a cycle that we go through more recent. This is something that we would go through probably more current. Counseling takes time. We try to be organized. We try to say, okay, we're at the office, then we come home, right? So when you're working with people, they need time and they need energy, but you have to figure out balance in the whole thing because we still have a couple of kids at home, teenagers, a young adult, and they need time. But if Bob is busy, occasionally on weekends he'll counsel, occasionally, and maybe we've been apart for a bit, or he comes home and he's really tired and I'm busy doing stuff, I start feeling sorry for myself. And I start kind of feeling ignored because there's a lot of stuff to be done around the house, right? And so I think, okay, and this is where my mother was pretty dominant and I'm kind of dominant, and so I think, okay, I'll just do it myself. That'll get them going, because if I start doing it, they go, whoa, you know, she doesn't know what she's doing. So I start doing it, and I kind of emotionally detach, and I kind of become self-focused because I'm thinking, well, fine, if you want to go counsel, you just counsel. I'll just do my thing. I got lots to do, loads of stuff to do. You know, I'm looking after the kids, and I'm looking after the kids, and I'm looking after the house, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that. And by the way, what are you doing? You know, the pressure. Now, where does that go? I look after all my duties as a wife and mother, but I'm not emotionally connecting with him. I'm just doing my own thing. And then, oh, maybe you're going to tell what I do. So then how does that work with him? I start to get controlling and all that kind of stuff, and then...
Well, she puts those expectations on me. Now, one thing we need to explain here, too, is you can resolve these issues. Like, I need to resolve my high expectations that I grew up with. I need to resolve that. And that's resolved when Jesus brings peace to that. And I can relax with that. But where we're damaged, we are always going to be sensitive. You can get healing for that, but you're always going to be sensitive to that. Let me illustrate that. We built our church out in the country 25 years ago, and it was donated by a fellow who lived beside the chapel there. And this fellow that donated the property, he was 89 when he died a few years ago. When he was a teenager, he was a traveling evangelist. He would just strike across northern Canada, go into an Indian village, hang a shingle on the town hall, gospel meetings here tonight, and people got saved. I mean, that was 70, 75 years ago. There was no TV or anything, so what was happening in the public was a place to be, but people got saved. Well, this fella got married early 20s, and got accused of something he didn't do, and so he became very bitter. Got away from God, got out of the church, became an alcoholic, raised his family through that time, lottery grants. But then when he was about 50 or 55, another traveling evangelist knocked on his door, and God, just randomly, and God used that to bring him back. Got delivered from the alcohol. And got back in ministry and did some amazing things from there till he died. And wasn't tempted to bring home a stash, wasn't tempted to go to a bar. But we have communion every Sunday, like I think you do here, and we used to use wine. And that's all we used. He couldn't come. Because if he had one little communion cup of wine, 5% alcohol, he would start to struggle and he'd want more. And what I'm illustrating is, if he had that much, he would want more. And what I'm illustrating is, where you're damaged, you can be free from it, but you're always going to be sensitive to it. So I resolved the high expectations. I resolved being controlled. But you know what? When somebody comes at me and starts controlling me again, I have a choice to make. Before, I would just get defiant. I would just an automatic reaction, just don't do that. Now I realize I have a choice. I can forgive that. And I can start looking at my wife and saying, okay, now, why is she getting controlling? Am I pushing her buttons? Can I just say something? What's that?
Can I just say something?
Oh, sure.
And just to wrap up what I was saying, when this happens, what I explained, I'm right in that same category of nobody cares, Bob doesn't care, I'm all alone, I have to strive to be better, I'm worthless, inadequate, pressure, way I go, to perform, detached, because I'm just doing my own thing. And as Bob said, how do we resolve that then? How should we resolve it? What are the tools that we can resolve it? And you started to say.
Yeah, I need to forgive that. And I need to be more sensitive to her and realize that, okay, if she's starting to control, that's a message to me that she's probably feeling, I don't care, worthless, inadequate. She feels pressure. And I need to start going to her. And I have a choice to make then. I can get defiant if I want still. But I am free not to now, and that's the difference.
And the difference between before we had counseling or understood this whole thing was that he might say, okay, let's make a list of what needs done around the house. Okay, let's start doing it. You know, and I'm like, okay, well, so? Like it was so mechanical, it was so intellectual. But as soon as somebody starts to care, you know it. Or if I'm saying to him, even if he is spending too much time at the office, I can reach out to him and I can care about that and I can say, oh man, you must just be exhausted and just work it out and care about him rather than caring about myself and what I'm doing.
And of course, when you have these emotional issues that we all have, add to it the family things that you deal with. I mean, if you want to know what kind of things you're going to struggle with spiritually in your family, in yourself, just look at your family tree. If you see a lot of pride, you're going to struggle with pride. So add that to all this stuff too. And it all gets, you know, and that's why you separate all these things out and start to deal with them. So basically the cycle is, when I feel rejected, I withdraw. She feels neglected, ignored, so she withdraws. I feel more rejection, she withdraws more, and around and around and around it goes. And I can take almost any marriage and figure that cycle out. And sometimes they just get tired of the cycle. I'm out of here. And any cycle can be resolved. Some are more difficult than others. But I can guarantee you, when you go through that and look in your own marriage, you're going to start to see that cycle. You hit each other's buttons. Oh, yeah, other relationships too. It's going to happen. Something's going to happen at work and somebody's going to hit that pain button, you're going to react. And the same cycle starts with other people as well. So that kind of puts in a capsule. Anything you want to share?
Nope.
Okay. As I've done this over the years, we've done this, a lot of parents are saying to their children as they've grown up and want to get married and everything looks good with this prospective spouse, they say, yep, we're all in favor, we're blessing this, but we want you to do one thing. We want you to go for a week of counseling. Because all the stuff you see in the screen, both of us brought to the marriage. It's not what goes on inside your marriage that causes the problem. It's what both of you have brought to the marriage. And so you can see single people can solve this stuff too. When I'm dealing with a single person, I do nothing different than with a couple. You just got one person. I'm helping them resolve their stuff. And premaritals, they hardly ever think they got a problem. I don't have any problems. And oftentimes this happens. They'll come in the first of the week, and you can kind of tell they're just kind of going through this. You know, they're there because mom and dad want them to. They don't really say that, but at the end of the week, you know what they say so many times? you know what? When we first came here, we really didn't think we needed this. We just did it for mom and dad. But we're so glad we did. And premaritals tend to not tell you the whole story because everything was wonderful. And one person, one guy, he told his story, and he had an extreme rejection problem. His anger was at the top, his dominant at the top. And he told his story, and everything was fine. He had a wonderful life. I kept asking questions, and it was great. I looked at my test, and I said, "Who made you so angry? Who dominated you?" He just stared at me, and he said, he went from this to my brother. And we started talking about that, and he started crashing. When I say crashing, I mean he just went into his heart and started hitting that pain, and he was able to walk him through it. Now, here's what would have happened if that didn't take place. 2 weeks after they're married or on the honeymoon, she'd get that full blast in the face. I have been shocked over the years at how many marriages die on the honeymoon. And depending on your background and your belief system, some people just stay together because that's what you're supposed to do. But they don't have relationship. It died on the honeymoon. I often say, you know, it takes about 2 weeks for all this stuff to hit the fan. And I've heard couples say, "Oh yeah? 2 hours after we were married, it just flew apart." And she's been doing it ever since. You know why we're laughing? Because we know it's true. So I want you to take about 5 minutes right now. We're just going to be quiet. Maybe Murray could play the piano for a bit. And I just want you to take this sheet and just start the process for yourself. Now, best if you don't peek at someone else's sheet. Just do your own. Don't do one for your spouse. Let them do their own. But just start. Did I get everybody's attention? Just start. Ask the Lord. Say, "Lord, just show me here issues that I struggle with." And just start this whole process. And just start checking off how I close my heart when, or I get irritated when this happens to me. And just start the process. We'll take 5 minutes to do that.
Bob talked about the hurt and your feelings and how you respond, and that you can break that cycle. That cycle can be broken so that you stop doing those things. But only if your hurts have been healed. If you know anything about how he works through some of those things, we take these things to Jesus and we ask Jesus to heal them and to touch them so that you can feel different. There's nobody that knows you like Jesus. And there's nobody that can touch those things and heal you like Jesus. And we may be shackled by heavy burdens. We may have things that affect us so negatively that we don't know which way to turn except to Jesus. And when Jesus touches us, he heals us and he makes us a new creation, a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. When Jesus touches us. And then you can sing this song with me. Shackled by a heavy started an exercise. If you want to take some more time to finish it, go ahead. But we're going to take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back in for the next session. You're dismissed.